There you are. It's perfect. It's pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, it's focused for me. My eyes are off. Okay, folks. Those of you who are still standing, please find a seat right now. Good. Yeah. So this lecture is posted on the web for you, and so you can review it. Okay. Those of you who are still talking, please stop talking now. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. All right. Today we are going to briefly introduce the Head and Neck organization. And this hopefully will help you as you are going to study what seems to be a very complicated arrangement of nerves and muscles. And with a little bit of help, I think I can untangle some of that complication for you today. First of all, if you're talking about head and neck, I think I need to cut this down. Bottom.
Okay, and then the conference.
Okay, let's see what we do here. That's good. What we, first of all, are faced with is who has a head? And when you're talking about individual animals in the animal kingdom that have a head, you very rapidly realize that those with the most believable heads are the vertebrates, and that the rest really runs around, the invertebrate groups are really running around with perhaps a simulacrum of a head, but nothing much more than that. Just for you to understand where we stand as far as our relationships are concerned in the animal kingdom, we belong to a group of deuterostomes. Just a little bit of background so that you can be intelligent about it. This is a superphylum. And this superphylum, the name is named after the fact that we have, as you will know, two openings, an oral opening and an anal opening. You have already encountered the anal opening in your dissections. The oral opening will shortly follow. And what you will find is, developmentally, the oral opening in us and in all the other members of this particular group that are shown here, develops after the anal opening. It's the second opening to develop. And that is what the term deuterostomes stands for. So the oral opening, the oral cavity, develops after the anal opening. That's one way of classifying a very large group of animals, as you can figure out. Now, these deuterostomes then further very quickly become branched into a group that are going to be interesting little things like starfish and urchins and things like that with a fivefold type of symmetry. But we have a bilateral symmetry. We are now in the phylum of the chordates. And our nearest relatives are the so-called urochordates. Now, what we have in common is a notochord, a central stem in our body, and that's why we are named chordates. Now, it is this group here, then, the branch that becomes the vertebrates and that has the head. I just want you to see some of our near relatives, the urochordates. Here's a sea squirt. Very happy little animal. It sits quietly on a nice surface. It has two openings. It has an oral opening, and it has an anal opening. Takes stuff in, sends stuff out. And basically, whatever comes floating by is taken in. That's the food. And then it discharges whatever garbage is left. And here is a single one, and this, of course, is a whole colony of them. And they're nice, quiet, peace-loving individuals. Now, what do the third, how do we differ? Well, we differ in one sense that we are moving. We are moving and we are hunting for our food. We are not just waiting and sitting around and waiting for it to come. And because we are hunting for food, we have to develop a certain kind of polarity in our body. We also have to address the problem of eating food, and we have to address also a system that is much more effective to get us oxygen. So we need to develop a breathing system. Now, how do we achieve that? We achieve that as follows. I'm going to draw you a little diagram because several things have to happen for the vertebrates to have developed. And what we are now going to show you here, it's like a whale. Well, okay. This is the ongoing end. The organism is moving in this direction. And when it moves in this direction, it is helpful to have all of the organs of special sense that are needed to detect the prey and to sense where the prey is by smell or by vibrations. All these organs of special sense are going to be in front. Okay? So there will be an eye. There will be an area of olfaction. And there will be an area that picks up vibration. Usually, in us, of course, it becomes an ear. And all of those are up front. They are there to gather data of where the prey that we need for our food is. And if you have all of this input, you need to have a place where you can actually integrate all that input and get an effective response. And so there is an area, bless you, of neural integration, which requires us to get a larger area of the neural tube in the head. And that, of course, is the brain. So the brain forms primarily at first to accommodate all of this input of the organs of special sense. Then it continues on as a simple tube for the rest of the body. So now we have that, and now let's see what else we need. What else we need is an opening. I have to kind of make an opening here, but that's what I'm going to do here. So you need an oral opening. And that we already had because we are chordates. And now you have a digestive tract that runs here. Here's the anal opening. Here's the oral opening. But you need also our jaws. So we need jaws to capture the prey and to masticate. So all of this has to be in the area of the head. And finally, and this is something that we have kind of grown past, but you need an area of more effective respiration. And in some of the vertebrates, that is still in the form of gills. We have gone past that and have developed lungs. Okay, so in our case, but that's not true for all vertebrates, we have a newer mechanism that is called the lung. So it is clear then, I hope, that the head has this series of functions. It has a series of organs with organs of special sense. It has an enlarged brain, and it has a very effective jaw apparatus to capture and masticate the prey. And that brings immediately up the second point, and that is there are a series of important cavities that are associated with front end of the head. And there's a nasal cavity, there's an oral cavity, two nasal cavities side by side, oral cavity. Then there is an area where the nasal cavity and the oral cavity cross, the pathways cross, as you know, where the air goes into the larynx and the food goes into the esophagus. And so all of these spaces are part of this highly adjusted system. This is where we have grown far beyond our very modest relatives, the urochordates. Now, the urochordates actually had a view of the future, And that means that they had, in fact, during the larval stage, a movable structure that's known as the larval tadpole. And there is something that's a little bit head-like. But once they get mature, hey, kids, don't mess with us. We're just going to sit. Okay. This is just kind of preview of coming attractions. Chordates are going places. And now let's see what the chordates are made of. What is the basic body plan of chordates, and how have we expanded on that when we became vertebrates? First of all, every chordate, and that includes the urochordates, has a dorsal hollow neural tube. The dorsal, that's of course your backside, you're familiar with the terminology. And so there's a dorsal hollow neural tube. There is a central notochord that you're seeing here in blue. You have probably not seen the notochord in your dissection because it is long since gone, but the notochord is in fact found at the position of the vertebral bodies. So when you follow the vertebral bodies in a vertical direction, you are in fact identifying the path of the notochord. The notochord was the precursor of the vertebral structures, and the intervertebral discs are in fact enlarged parts of the old notochord. So there's a remnant of it left, actually. Now, another very important thing is that the mesoderm, have you come in human development, have you encountered the word mesoderm, the term and the concept? Okay, so you know what mesoderm is, and you know that it gets segmented. And so all chordates have lateral bars of segmented mesoderm, and that is true for all of us. And then finally, there's an area on the ventral side that is the digestive tube. So this is what we all have in common, and some of the urochordates have, in fact, pharyngeal gill slits. Now, how did we change? Here is the common tree. This is a cladogram of the invertebrates, deuterostomes. This is the point of departure where the chordates are going. So this line is now the chordate line. And what you're seeing here is that a notochord develops here. And then a group of cells develops here that is neurocrest. Is the neurocrest familiar to you? Yeah, good. I'm glad. So neurocrest is here. And actually, the neurocrest probably started a little earlier right here. But those were, in fact, important changes that were needed for the development of the vertebrates. Well, of course, let's now see what it means. The vertebrates, when we evolved, had the following things. Organs of special sense. I showed it to you in that simple diagram. The organs of special sense are needed to detect your prey. Development of a large neural circuitry, the brain. Integrate the input and coordinate the responses. Development of an effective feeding apparatus. And that would be the jaws. And what you'll find is the jaws are the derivatives of the pharyngeal arches. Now, some of you may know what pharyngeal arches are, but I know that I'm going to give you that lecture a little while from now, so you don't know what pharyngeal arches are until you heard my lecture. Okay? So, pharyngeal arch derivatives are very important for us. And then, of course, you need an improved respiratory apparatus. The gills in fishes, for example, and tadpoles, are pharyngeal arch derivatives. But what we have is also a series of pharyngeal arches during development. And that particular set of structures, the pharyngeal arches, required a whole new group of cells, neurocrest cells, which in fact they existed already, but they needed to assume a new role. So far, I think you have heard about the neural role of neurocrest cells and the fact that they become melanoblasts and the fact that they become, bless you, adrenal medulla. But the thing is that there is in fact another role for neurocrest cells in the head and neck, where they are going to become primitive connective tissue, mesenchyme. Okay, and that is something that is unique for the neurocrest cells in the head and neck area, and that is what is needed to build those new structures, those pharyngeal arches that are so critical for us in the development of our head and neck. So let's briefly look at the situation developmentally. We have a series of placodes, and the placodes develop in advance of the organs of special sense. They are the key for the organs of special sense. There are olfactory placodes. There is a lens placode for the eye. And there is an otic placode, which is not marked, actually, but it is this one right here, for the and here it is otic vesicle at this point. That is for the organs of hearing and balance. So these are the placodes that are going to form the organs of special sense. And again, this is a lecture that I will talk to you about in much more detail somewhere a little bit later in the year. And this is what the neurocrest is doing. The neurocrest actually migrates from the closing neural tube, and it migrates down in this direction. All the way over here, over here. And the neurocrest cells that are migrating in this way become limited to the area that is indicated here in blue. So there's a distinct boundary, and the boundary is between mesodermal connective tissue and neurocrest-derived connective tissue. Okay, so what you're seeing then, I hope that it becomes clear to you, that aside from the neural skull, the rest of the head and neck is really going to be formed by cells that have a neurocrest origin. Okay, that's a very critical point to memorize and to realize. And so what you say is, what does neurocrest contribute? Does it contribute to the neurocranium? Absolutely not. Does it contribute to the viscerocranium? Yes. Does it contribute to the somatic neck? No. Does it contribute to the visceral neck? Yes. So very specific and very defined. And when you do the dissection of the neck especially, you will in fact bring forward the structures that are part of the visceral neck and separate them from the structures that are forming the somatic neck. And it is a very clean separation. There are very few structures that actually pass between those. So like a fascial plane, you can literally dissect it and then move the rest of the head forward. And so that's what you're seeing here. What you're seeing here now, and which you will get to know in great detail, is the area of the visceral head and the visceral neck. And you're seeing here, of course, that includes the area of the nasal cavities, the area of the oral cavities, all of this. And then here you have the visceral neck, and it is very cleanly separated right here from the somatic neck. And this is one of our favorite pictures. It's kind of gory, but what you're seeing here is a picture that shows you the neck after the guillotine has been placed on it, and what you're left with now is a very clear picture. That's not really a good one. Okay, let me just do this one. A very nice picture here that you can draw this line and say, this is the visceral neck on the ventral side, and this is the somatic neck, okay, on the dorsal side. And if you look closely here, you see a little opening in this center of the vertebral body. That's the location of the notochord. So it actually shows, okay? The notochord kind of stays with it more or less. So now that we have understood that part, the visceral neck, the somatic neck, viscerocranium, neurocranium, and we know that when the terms viscero are applied to those two regions, that it in fact means that those parts are formed by contributions of neurocrest cells. So now let's look at the pharyngeal arches, since they seem to play a rather important role. Bless you. They are a phylogenetically late acquisition, pharyngeal arches, and the specific role that the neurocrest assumes really is limited to the group of vertebrates. The chordates may have some pharyngeal segmentation, but it really the actual pharyngeal arches are limited to the vertebrates. And what are they? They are a series of five, and there is some reason to believe that there was originally a sixth, paired segments, meaning that it is bilateral. We have bilateral symmetry, so they are paired segments, one on the right, one on the left, that are wedged, and that's the point, into the older series of 33 to 34 paired somatic segments, which form somites, and that was that segmented lateral mesoderm that we saw in that simple diagram of the chordates. So if you recall, there were these two simple segmented lateral mesoderm that is forming a series of 33 to 34 paired segments, and these new segments, these pharyngeal arches, literally are wedged inside that group of these somites. So what you're seeing here, and there is two stages of development of the embryos, you're seeing that they don't all these segmental arches don't all form at the same time. So this is one, this is two, this is three. There's only three here. A little bit later on, one, two, three, and you see a fourth appearing. And you see that these are located in this particular position between the forebrain, which is here, and the heart, which is here developing. And so they're wedged between those two structures, but they are also wedged between the somites. And there are a couple of somites here, one, two, three. And then the rest of the somites just continue on until you reach about 34. So this group of pharyngeal arches, these segments, are literally wedged in between. They only exist for about 2 weeks of embryonic development, which makes it almost trivial. You say, oh, what can these dumb things do? Well, actually, they do a lot because they give rise to some important components of the, especially of the neck, and will help us in our description of the organization. So let's look at this. Here is an interesting picture. Think of yourself as an embryo, and a cut is made in a plane which is parallel to the front, a frontal section, in such a way, let's just go back here for a second, in such a way that the front end is cut off and that you can see now separately. And what you're seeing here now, what is left behind the back end, you're seeing here a cut through these pharyngeal arches. They're little rounded structures. They're kind of stacked on each other. Sometimes there's a little opening, transient pharyngeal slit. Here's an opening too. So there are temporarily pharyngeal slits. You see it here also. There's a little slit here. So developmentally, we actually form little gill slits. But they very quickly disappear, and unless they disappear poorly and leave a developmental anomaly behind, you never know that you had them. But here are these pharyngeal arches. So one, two, three, and again the fourth just beginning over here. So that is one thing. Now you have to ask yourself another question: is how did we get jaws? Because jaws is an even later acquisition. We started out with a group of relatives, some of which are still around, and they are known as the jawless fishes. And the lampreys are an extant group that actually still is swimming around. And this is what they look like. They don't have jaws. They have gills. You can see the gills here. But, and this is a whole series running forward, but they don't have an upper and a lower jaw. So that is kind of a little complication that we have overcome. In a jawless fish, jawless here, what you have is a series of skeletal structures, and you have a final skeletal structure in the front, which you can say is a lower jaw. It's not really a lower jaw because you don't have an upper jaw. If you don't have an upper jaw, you don't have a lower jaw. That's one of those situations. But what you have in the top here is an upper lip. Okay. Now, there's just a minor shift in the genetic code which controls the patterning here, and now that leads to the development of structure as we have it, with an upper jaw, maxilla, and a lower jaw, the mandible. Okay? So the jaws are acquired relatively quickly that way. And there's a big discussion as to where did this upper jaw come from. And the general agreement now is, if this is the lamprey on the left side, which is the jawless situation, you're seeing this is the site, this blue arrow, that is the site of the oral opening, and this structure here is that one of those pharyngeal arch skeletal structures, and so it's just there to, quote, make the lower jaw. So the lower jaw is just that, and there's an upper lip here which has no skeletal structure in it. Once you have a vertebrate with a set of jaws, you now have an oral opening which is at this level, and if you look close, you say, oh, that goes right through the middle of that skeleton of the first arch, the first pharyngeal arch, and that means that this part is going to become the maxilla, and this part is going to be the mandible. Okay? So what we did, we literally took that first arch skeleton and subdivided it into an upper and a lower jaw. That's the development as it occurred. All right. Now let's look at what these pharyngeal arches do for us. First of all, you have a series of segmental blood vessels. Each arch has its own blood vessel, and these are known as the aortic arches. And we number the aortic arches 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. Remember I said there were 5 or 6 arches. The 6th has kind of disappeared, and the one that has disappeared is number 5. Just for fun, that's all that amounts to. It's not a big deal. Okay, where it becomes important for you, and now let's look at the mature situation. The structures that you have, the skeleton of these pharyngeal arches, number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6, are going to give rise to a series of skeletal structures in the adult, which pretty much outline where the pharyngeal arches were located. And do this, just humor me, okay? Put your index finger on your mandible, and then fan your fingers down your neck, like this. Those are the positions of the pharyngeal arch skeletal elements. Okay, and so what you find is that the first arch, one, was located here, the second one was located here, 3 was located here, and 4 and 6 were located here. And that particular set of structures, those derivatives of the pharyngeal arches, really are pretty much in the location where they originally developed. And what have they left behind? Well, they have left behind these structures here, the malleus, the incus, and the stapes. Those are the ossicles of the middle ear. Ignore the allis sphenoid for now, because that is really not part of my discussion. It probably is derived from the first arch cartilage, but never mind. Now, the rest of the first arch cartilage does not contribute. Listen closely to me. The mandible is, in fact, not formed by the first arch cartilage. What the first arch cartilage does form is 2 very important ligaments. The anterior ligament of the malleus, which we'll come to know more about once you are doing the ear. So the anterior ligament of the malleus and the sphenomandibular ligament, the attachment point of which you will shortly get to recognize. Those are derived from the skeleton of the first pharyngeal arch. All the rest, which originally started out as a cartilage, Meckel's cartilage, just disappears. Okay? Does not give rise to the mandible. So please make that note so that you don't get lost as you start studying the material, that the mandible is not formed by a pharyngeal arch cartilage. But when you go further down, what you're seeing is the styloid process. Remember the styloid process? Comes from the second arch. The body of the higher part of it and the lesser horn comes from the second arch. So that is second. And then the ligament between the two, the stylohyoid ligament, also comes from the second arch. Okay? There's one continuous line. It's very easy to see how that all is derived from the original cartilage. And now when you go a little bit further down, the rest of the body of the hyoid, most of it really, is from the third arch, as is the greater horn of the hyoid, that's third arch. And then the cartilages of the larynx are from the fourth and the sixth arch. We are not making as clean a separation there because the origin is a little bit more muddled, but that's a general statement. Fourth and sixth arch give rise to the cartilages of the larynx. So this is a very easy thing to see, that the derivatives are quite clear. And you see it here in the adult, that is, you can still see the outline, somewhere, and I'm going to have to do this in another color, this would be the position of the first arch cartilage, which is now, of course, no longer there except for the ligaments. This is the styloid process, which you, of course, have already seen, the stylohyoid ligament here, and the lesser horn of the hyoid here. And then body of hyoid and greater horn of hyoid here, and here again the laryngeal cartilages. Okay? So these are clearly identifiable as direct remnants of the pharyngeal arches. Now let's look at the muscles. Because what you find is, and you will see that in your dissections, the muscles are grouped according to their origin in the various pharyngeal arches. So you have the muscles of arch 1. Those are important muscles for you guys. The muscles of mastication. Okay, there's going to be a masseter muscle, a temporalis muscle, the pterygoids. Muscles of mastication are all from the first arch. And what they have in common is that they are innervated by the nerve of the first arch. Now that's very, very nice and decent of them. So once you know that the muscle comes from a first arch, you immediately can remember that they are innervated by the trigeminal nerve. Arch 2 gives rise to the muscle of facial expression. The muscles of facial expression do a lot of traveling because as the head begins to grow and spread, the various areas begin to spread out and assume different positions, the muscles of facial expression really are dispersed much more widely than the other muscles. But what they have in common is that they are innervated by the nerve of the second pharyngeal arch. That kind of ties them all together. Arch 3 has only one muscle, stylopharyngeal muscle, which is innervated by the nerve of the third arch. And then you have the muscles of the larynx, largely cranial nerve 10. They are coming, of course, they are muscles that formed by the muscle mass of pharyngeal arches 4 and 6. Now what they've done here is to lay out for you the different cranial nerves according to the kind of cranial nerves that they are. And what you have, in fact, we have now discussed during this particular hour, we have discussed the fact that there are organs of special sense. They have their own innervation, and they are marked by the color... Oops, wrong... They are marked by the color green. Okay, so that is, these are the nerves of special sense, for the organs of special sense. Then we talked about the somatic segmentation, the somites, and there are some nerves that are related to the somatic segmentation. They are marked in red. And finally, marked in blue are the nerves that are associated with the pharyngeal arches. So we have three sets of nerves that can be identified that way, and that are related to the, bless you, the particular origins of the structures that they are innervating. Now let's look at the picture here. We start out with green, and we're just now going to lay them out, because now this, I hope, will make sense for you as you start going there. There's a lot of discussion going on in this section. It disturbs me. Could you please hold it down? Okay, olfactory nerve 1, optic nerve number 2, and here is the nerve that is barely visible, not much to draw, and that is the vestibulocochlear nerve, cranial nerve 8. So these now are marked in green. Now let's look at the nerves of somatic segmentation. All those nerves are associated with the muscles that are moving the eye. So, bless you, except for one, which is number 12. So you have number 3, nerve number 3, the oculomotor. Nerve number 4, trochlear. Nerve number 6, abducens. And then, as I said, the pharyngeal arches were kind of wedged in between that pattern of somitic segmentation. And so the next somitic nerve, the next nerve of somitic segmentation, is coming over here. And that is the hypoglossal nerve, which kind of takes an interesting turn. And we'll talk about that because it makes it so very interesting in the anatomy of the head and neck. Now, the final set of nerves, which are really the most interesting of them all, are the nerves of the pharyngeal arches. And so we have the trigeminal nerve, the facial nerve, glossopharyngeal, and 11 accessory, the vagus and the accessory. Now notice what I did here. Each time when I came to the area of the arches, I branched them. And that means that, for example, if we now look at the nerve that is really the most critical in your life, a trigeminal nerve, it goes to the first arch. This is arch 1. But it has a little branch that goes to the area in front of it. The same thing for facial nerve here. Little branch that goes into arch 1. Most of it goes in arch 2. How can we explain that? Well, when you look at the branchiomeric nerves, these different branches, these different rami, split around the gill slits. And that is a pattern that you can find back in animals that have gills, but you can find it also back in us because we have the pharyngeal arches, which in effect are shared with the animals that have gills. And so what we have is a situation where we have a gill slit like this here, and that gill slit is known as a trema. Trema. And so what you now find is that, and here is number 9, cranial nerve number 9, so that's fine. Cranial nerve number 9 has a branch that goes down in the third arch, but it has also a branch that lies in front of the slit, so-called pretraumatic ramus, which goes to the arch before, the second arch in our case. But that is only part of the nerve. What you're seeing is that the nerve has been shown as both with its sensory roots and its motor roots. And the motor root is this little interrupted line that you're seeing here. So this here is the motor root. And you notice that the motor root is only lying post-traumatic, behind the gill slit, which is, in fact, in the proper arch. So when we say the trigeminal nerve is the nerve of the first arch, what we are saying is that the post-traumatic branches, both the afferent and the efferent, are in the arch. But there is another afferent pre-traumatic branch that goes in front of it. Okay? And that is true. You can follow that through for the seventh cranial nerve, the ninth cranial nerve, and at that point I'm not going to bother very much more with that. So now let's just look at this thing once more and now just identify the nerves of the branchiomeric segments in blue. And so what you find is, and now let's look at the trigeminal nerve because that's really important for you to concentrate on. The trigeminal nerve has a post-traumatic afferent branch and a pre-traumatic afferent branch. And then it has added onto it a little third branch, also afferent. And but that's an addition, okay? That is not normal for the other pharyngeal arch nerves. This would be the first division of the trigeminal nerve, the second division of the trigeminal nerve, or maxillary division, and the third division of the trigeminal nerve, or mandibular division. Those are all afferent, sensory branches. But now we are going to just add on the motor root, and the motor root only goes in here. And so now immediately what you are going to say is, aha, when I look at the branches of the first and second division of the trigeminal nerve, I don't have to worry about motor fibers, only afferent fibers. The only motor fibers are going to be in this area with the third division. And that can be repeated for the facial nerve. The facial nerve again has a post-traumatic branch here and a pre-traumatic branch. And that pre-traumatic branch you will get to know as the chorda tympani. So it actually is a specific branch that you will get to know, associated with taste. And then, so this is number 7. And then we'll go for the glossopharyngeal nerve, which again has post-traumatic branch and a pre-traumatic branch and a motor branch which just goes to that one single muscle that it innervates. But this pre-traumatic branch is known as the tympanic nerve of Jacobson. And so that's how you can, in an area where you say, well, this has to be innervated by, say, the seventh cranial nerve, you can find some branches that come from the ninth cranial nerve. And if you are in the area of the mandible, where you have mostly the trigeminal nerve, you will have a little branch coming in the chorda tympani from the seventh nerve. Okay? And so it is all very pretty and actually very nicely organized. And it is at this point that I would like to finish up this session and hope that this will help you a little bit as you're studying.